I spent the first couple of years in a hostel where I had to share a room with two others. Yeah, knew nothing about, some of my belongings were getting stolen, and yeah, loads of crazy things were happening. I pretty much lived out of a rucksack. Had a sleeping bag that was bought for me from Hope Pal, which is something that, has always stuck with me.
Hello and welcome to our final episode of Series 1, Talent Takes Practice, a podcast looking at what it takes to make it to the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help youngsters maximise their own talents, whatever those talents may be. So Rob, I haven't seen you for a while, mate. How you're looking good, actually, I have to say. Your hair is lustrous.
Yeah, and my body's even better. I don't know if you've seen photos on Instagram. My home gym's been working. I've got to say, I look absolutely sensational.
Funnily enough, I phoned you the other day at the weekend, and you called back 3 hours later, and I said, "What have you been doing?" Three hours every day in the gym.
Two hours every day in the gym, mate. For my mental, it really helps me mentally and physically. It was hard online, obviously, online session, but my motivation, my desire, because the thing. As I've said on previous podcasts, Matthew, I was the skinny kid in school. I was very body aware. And ever since I retired, I thought, do you know what? I want to be that person on holiday who can wear a T-shirt on its own or a pair of skinny jeans. Do you know what I mean? But I was always that person who would wear baggy clothes to hide my skinny frame. So, I'm embracing it now. Listen, I get hammered on Instagram. What, your 46-year-old man posting, pictures of himself with no top on? But you know what, I'm embracing it. All my life I've struggled with my body being skinny and not having any muscles, so now I'm embracing it. You should try it.
But Rob, the funny thing for me is that you're doing it for body image. I made a big mistake about 2 months ago. I told you about it already, that one of the things I started doing is saying, right, no, I'm having to do it myself now, which is funny because you can't get behind the ears if you don't have a barber doing it. No, but I stopped going out and running. I thought, we're in lockdown. I got into a rut where I wasn't doing any physical. And the thing that really has changed things for me is when you go out and run and you get that release and you can free your mind from the daily grind and sometimes those little arguments that you have that are trivial, really, but you can really get a sense of perspective when you're out there. And it reminds me, Rob, of something you said to me early on during the first lockdown, that sport and exercise is critical for the mental health of young people. And you've been keeping a running campaign, a brilliant campaign. Where are we with that? Just for the listeners.
So it's amazing, Matthew, that, I'm on a WhatsApp group with Matt Hancock and Nigel Huddleston, the sports minister. I'm also I've got a great relationship now with the FA, senior people. The doctor at the FA, Dr. Charlotte Cowie, who's I've been dealing with to get my facts and my research right. And it's amazing to think now that as we're recording this podcast, it's been announced that the 29th grassroots sports can come back, which I think is a great thing. I wanted it. I didn't want it. I thought that the 8th of March, when schools are back, because there's going to be mixing of bubbles, sports allowed at school, youngsters congregating at break time outside of school, on school buses, so I thought that it would be perfect that having education being allowed, sport should be in parallel with it. But as Mr. Oliver Dowden said on social media, that grassroots sports would be first out, that being the 29th, so he's true to his word. So I cannot wait for these youngsters to be back. Physical activity, Matthew, increases the mental well-being of youngsters. We know that. It improves concentration. And kids are going to need to concentrate more than ever now. Catching up at school. Why are you laughing?
It was when you said...
I'm trying to think of the word. I couldn't think of a word.
Football really helps concentration.
Yeah, I couldn't think. I was concentrating.
Sorry, I feel terrible.
It also helps build immunity. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It can help
build
immune system. Yeah. I, on that, talking about how, as Matthew, this pandemic has changed the landscape of lots of things. And one thing I believe it's changed is the landscape of grassroots sports and families' ability to continue paying, you know, in some circumstances where family circumstances have changed, whether it's due to a marriage breakdown, due to furlough, due to, you know, losing jobs. So I've launched the Savage Foundation, and it's in partnership with a fantastic gentleman, Andrew Law, from the Law Family Charitable Foundation, who's funding it. Macclesfield FC have given us 7.5 hours free pitch space to create free training and a free league. Kitlocker.com have provided kits for all the youngsters, and it's going to be free. So for me, that was a dream of mine. It's great. As I say, the landscape has changed. So regardless of ability or background, there's opportunities now for free football, for grassroots football, and for development centres. And these kids in the foundation, Matthew, if they want that next level of competitive grassroots football, we'll fund that for them as well. So I'm delighted. It's my passion. I love it. I care about it. But I cannot wait to see these youngsters running around in the fresh air, enjoying themselves, having fun.
It's a funny thing, Rob, because I think successive governments from Margaret Thatcher onwards in 1979, they've never really understood the power of sport to help people in all the different ways you describe, all those different dimensions, mentality, physically. I see it with my young son, Teddy. You know, I now live in, you know, a middle-class family. I grew up in a work, like you, in a working-class context. But
you live in Richmond, you live in Richmond, don't you?
Southwest, exactly, in Richmond, south as well. But see, but seeing Teddy out there, Rob, see, you know, it's amazing to see, particularly when you think the risk of infection is so low when you're outside. And what he gets from being, because they're developing their social faculties at that age. It's not just about learning about football per se. It's learning about how to interact with other people, how to be part of a team, how to lose with dignity, how to build physical literacy. The fact that you've been passionate about this, I think there is an outside chance. You know, it's WhatsApp group. I didn't know about that with Hancock and Dowden. You know, trying to get politicians with their hands on the levers of power. This is something that no one could get through to Thatcher. I think Blair got it to an extent, but this, I think, could be a really good departure point for our country, even as we come out of the pandemic. Think about it, Robbie. We're in the middle of an obesity crisis. You know, physical health is absolutely paramount in sport. I'm not saying it's a whole answer, but it's part of the answer, right?
You're talking about the Conservative government there. I've seen you've been shying away and panicking from Piers Morgan's tirade, you know, saying you're mixing with Jeremy Hunt and these people. You know, you bottled it, didn't you?
But what do you mean?
You bottled
what
it. You haven't answered him back.
What do you mean?
You run away from Piers. Yeah, he's just ping-ponged you off.
That's ridiculous. That is an absolutely ridiculous way
to ping-ponged you off. The ping-pong man, mate. You play in the Olympics. You do the paper shift at 2:30 in the morning on Sky News. Mate, you're all over the place. You've got a podcast on Radio 4, and he ping-ponged you off.
What do you mean? No. Don't be ridiculous. If you rewind to the column that I wrote about Piers Morgan, where I criticised his superficiality, his scapegoating of high-profile people for complex problems, I stand by that argument. He continues to do that even now. However, when he started calling me out on Twitter and on GMB, using airtime to try and criticise my table tennis playing prowess, if I'd gone after him on Twitter, I would have been undermining my own argument that Twitter spats demean everybody. But when you WhatsApped him and said, Matthew is prepared to debate you live on television, and I said, I'm up for it. Don't deny it, Rob. You WhatsApped him and said, will you take on Matthew's side live on television? He said, no. Panicking. You're so scared of him. Look at you.
He's my friend. Listen, I love watching. I've said it on a previous point. I like watching Piers Morgan. I understand both points. But, you know, I'm surprised at you because I think in a debate, he would have too much for you.
Come on. Well, why do you think when you WhatsApped him? When you WhatsApped, tell you what, Robbie, you are creasing me up as you always do.
This is our last episode of this series. Hopefully, we'll be back for more. What's been your standout moments? Your best bits? Who have you liked having on? Listen, they've all been.
I tell you, can I say? Look, I think The selection of guests. Well, I was going to say the selection of guests has been absolutely fascinating. The people who were even better than I expected, Ian Poulter. Do you remember our conversation before he came on? I was saying why are we having Ian Poulter on? He's never won anything. And then we realised his agent was on. By the way, I should say, I don't know how much I'm allowed to mention about this, but Robbie Williams, which was, that was the last episode that went out.
Magnificent.
Rob, I got to say this, Rob, the mentality of Robbie Williams. What a remarkable person, and a deep person.
Yeah, Robbie was brilliant. Listen, every guest we've had, Steph Reid, mate. Wow, what a story, Steph.
Steph Reid,
incredible, unbelievable. Every guest we've had has been remarkable. One of my favourites was Tony Whelan.
Yeah.
You know, and after that podcast, he, have I told you this story, or did I mention on the podcast that he turned up to one of our under 15 games and he brought his Pele shirt for the youngsters to see it. And he told them the story of him going out to America, playing against Pele, and he brought the shirt of Pele in a frame for the kids to have a photograph with. And he spoke to them, he sat them down. It was amazing, mate.
That's
it was
brilliant.
An amazing thing to see, the respect that man has, and the messages that ex-footballers have text me to say, have you got Tony Whelan's number? I listen on the podcast. For me, that was for a grassroots person to listen to Tony was quite remarkable, and that for me was amazing.
Yeah, no, I think it was brilliant, and I don't know if you look at the review, and thank you to everyone who's posted reviews on iTunes, because Robbie and I read them and, you know, we learn from them. The feedback on Tony Whelan was just perhaps the best we've had out of any podcast.
And I think the first one, Anton and Rio together.
Oh, fantastic.
You know, Rio talking about his relationship with the father. His father, we used to get in the car on the way home, and you know, it was, everything has been remarkable, his relationship with Anton. I think it's been we could mention every guest for different reasons, Matthew, couldn't we? They've all been incredible.
Could we mention, how many have we not said so far who's been on the show? Got Steph Reid, Judy Murray, Poulter, Rio and Anton, Robbie Williams. Who are we missing out?
Sesk was great as well.
Sesk. That was great. That was incredible. Sesk.
Is that everybody?
I think that. Well, if let me have a look in the chat function.
Ben Francis.
Gymshark, what an entrepreneur. Yeah. Initiative, dynamism.
For me, I forgot about this person. Brendan Rodgers.
Brendan.
Elite mentor.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, marvellous. And what a nice man.
And the way
he
talked to me, Matthew, about what I did wrong in that moment as a grassroots coach. I've told my coaches.
Yeah. He kind of criticised you for taking a player off, didn't he?
But he said, you learn from that.
Right.
What's been the best thing for you? What have you learned?
Thanks, Rob. Yeah, let me perhaps reflect on it, because I've learned an incredible amount. But if I had to pick out one distinctive lesson, it's that sometimes it's easy, particularly for me as an author and journalist, and perhaps for you as well as a performer and coach, to think there is a single pattern of success, that there's a formula that you can plug into and ensure that you get to where you want to be. What strikes me about these different people is they've had different lives, different personalities, different characters, different trajectories. And in actual fact, I think one of the great insights of great coaching is not pretending that every single player you're working with is homogenous, that they're all the same as each other. You have to understand who they are as individuals and therefore allow them to develop in their own idiosyncratic way. And I think all of these people, what they share in common is passion, belief, resilience. You know, they've got all of those ingredients, and I think that they are undeniably important if you want to really reach your potential. But it's a variety, Rob, that hits me hardest when you look back at the kind of the mosaic of all those different ingredients that went into each of these different incredible lives.
Do you know, also as well, the biggest thing that struck me is in every guest cases, things get mentioned. The biggest two words that get mentioned, hard work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Hard work.
Right.
You know, there's bumps in the road, isn't there? As you said, different trajectories. There's been disappointments, there's been highs, there's been lows. It's not a smooth path, is it? And for me, every single guest we've had on has said about hard work. Nothing's come easy to any of them.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Rob, because, you know, I don't want to get overly political, but occasionally you hear people saying that everything is just about circumstances. Either you're lucky or you're unlucky. I don't know if you're noticing this coming more into political debate. And I think what you just said, that taking ownership, showing personal responsibility, having the grit to wake up early and go for that morning run or whatever it happens to be. I'm not saying that context doesn't matter. Of course it does. Luck does make a difference. But unless we're prepared to take ownership for our own decisions, to live and, you know, to stand by those decisions, I think you never really fulfill your potential. So those two words, I think hard work probably are the ones that shine out the loudest. They don't shine. That's the wrong phrase, isn't it? Shine out the loudest. Speak out the loudest is what I meant.
Yeah.
It's interesting looking at some of the comments, Rob. Gascoigne06, loved listening to the few I've heard so far. Cesc was the best for me. Fantastic insight into his mindset and positivity. Loved it. Keep up the great work. Janboy1234, Tony Whelan. What a great advert for youth football. You could hear the passion in his voice. You're right, Jamboy, you really could. Hubie60, great podcast with Ben Francis. Inspirational young man. How do we get this mentality into the curriculum for young people? We should talk about that, Rob. And then one other that I picked out. What on earth does Rob... What on earth does Robbie know about talent? It's like getting Diane Abbott to do a maths podcast.
Why do you put that out?
Funny enough, I think that was a producer. Where is Mike Colt today? Is he here? Is he on the call? Don't think he is he?
I think it's great. I think this is people like Matt give me fuel to be successful. Comments like that.
Are you really upset? About it?
No, but this is what I thrive on. This is what makes me the person I am. This is the fuel I have. Because I had talent, but my little bit of talent, I got where I got to through sheer hard work. So I know we have a laugh and a joke, but comments like that fuel me to be successful every single day. And I know it might be a bit tongue-in-cheek, but it does.
That mindset, you apply that to football, but you apply it to the podcast, your broadcasting. Don't notice it every time I listen to your commentary, but it really does make a difference.
Yeah, somebody has to apply themselves to a podcast because you're sitting in that seat. Get Kathy to turn up your mic on. The radiator's buzzing in the background. Then we have to start. So listen, somebody's got to apply himself to this podcast. And if it wouldn't, you wouldn't know what all the awards you've won.
The thing is, people ask me if you're the same in real life. He's exactly like this. He's exactly the same. By the way, we have our guest.
We're back with the next question shortly. But first, we want to tell you about this. Is there something interfering with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. The service is available for clients worldwide. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counsellor. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room as with traditional therapy. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. Visit their website and read their testimonials that are posted daily. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Talent Takes Practice listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/talent. Join over the 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional.
Joining us today is England's most capped professional footballer of all time. With 172 appearances, Farrell Williams represented her country in 6 major international competitions, was part of Team GB in the London 2012 Olympics, and also awarded an MBE in 2016 for services to football and to charity. I mean, I really think an inspirational guest. She's shown determination, talent, tackled a huge amount of adversity too to reach the top of her field. This is a podcast. This is going to be about much more than football, believe me. But Rob, you're obviously a big fan of Farrah, but also good friends, right?
Yeah, you know, Fazza and myself, we've done a podcast together before, you know, and listened to Farrah's story, and it is quite an incredible, inspirational story, what Farrah had to go through in her life, you know, never mind just on the football field. And recently, you know, Farrah, I'm sure, will come on to her illness of you know, just in the last 4 or 5 weeks. And now, thankfully, she's getting back to full fitness. But her story is probably a story like no other we'll probably hear, Matthew.
Fascinating. Well, look, Farah, thanks so much for joining us. And you know, perhaps we could start with, you know, how did you first realise that you had a talent for football?
When I was allowed to play on the estate with the rest of the boys. I think, you know, years ago, I grew up on an estate in Battersea, and pretty much the whole estate was boys that played in the cage, and I was, you know, the only girl in there with them. So, you know, I believe that if I wasn't good enough to be in that cage with them, then I certainly would have been chucked out. So I think, you know, it was from very young that I realised, you know, that I could mix it amongst some of the lads.
Two things. How old were you at the time? And also, what was it like? Because I'm guessing that some of the boys will have found it difficult to have had a girl in the cage playing football with them, and perhaps even occasionally, or more than occasionally, outdoing them.
Yeah, I mean, as young as maybe 6, 7, pretty much most of my early years were spent in the cage. I was pretty lucky. I had a younger brother that was, you know, a year between us, and an older brother 3 or 4 years older than me. So lucky in terms of, you know, if they're in the cage with me, I was always allowed in there anyway. So, but I had that balance, you know. My older brother was, you know, I believe was a very good footballer. And he was somebody that challenged me physically every single day because he was so big and strong. And then my little brother was the one that, you know, probably gave me the confidence, because at the time, you know, he was a lot smaller than me, and I was able to, you know, outdo him most of the time, until obviously he grew into a big, strong teenager, and then things started to change.
So take us back before those 172 caps and the MBE you always mentioned to me all the time. You even got it on your WhatsApp MBE, which you should be proud of, but you do mention it all the time. Take me back before that. So as a female in Battersea playing with the boys, how many other females were playing? What was it like for you? Did you have to play in a mixed team? Was there girls' teams? How difficult was it?
Yeah, really difficult. I pretty much didn't know anything about any teams, female teams anyway, growing up. The only football I got really was at youth club. I used to try and make a girls' team out of the girls that used to go to the youth club with me. And every tournament I knew that was going to, you know, coming up with Metropolitan Police, they used to run a tournament every year, whether it be our youth club running a tournament or other youth clubs, I'd grab 5 girls that would come along and take part just so that I could play within that tournament. So it was difficult, you know, these girls had no interest in football, but certainly played their part in, you know, helping me develop and certainly me being able to then showcase myself at these tournaments. I think, you know, as much as they didn't want to go themselves, if it wasn't for them, I probably wouldn't have got picked up the way that I did. So yeah, it was difficult. I didn't play in a team until I was 11. And even when I was 11, I was playing in the team that was under 14. So I was playing under another name for a whole year. So that was quite fun, having different names every single week. But yeah, but then I moved on to Chelsea when I was 12. And that come of, I used to go to every Chelsea game at home. And there was a little small advertisement in the programme. And I pretty much went to the trials and was selected from there.
Which is remarkable. But the thing that obviously struck me reading about your incredible backstory is this statistic. 6 years, you were homeless whilst playing elite sport, representing your country at the Euros 2005. At that point, you were living in a hostel. What? Just take us into what your life was like at that time.
Do you know what? Football, for me, then was my focus. I mean, I mentioned loads of times before, you know, the difficulty is I love the game so much that I pretty much dedicated every bit of me to it. And that means working, you know, side jobs to get some money so that I can pay to play, which is what, you know, as females we had to do back in the day. And yeah, so football for me, you know, through my upbringing, when times were hard at home, when we was younger, it used to be my out. It used to be somewhere where I could go and literally close off everything that was going on around me. So it was a, you know, a great escape for me, and something that served me really well in terms of switching off. So yeah, it was difficult, but it gave me structure. Certainly allowed me to continue to develop as a player without concentrating too much on what was going on around me.
You weren't living in a home at this point. You were living in hostels. I mean, also on the street at any point?
Yeah, I spent a night on the street, and that was, yeah. And then I ended up the following day going to King's Cross, and basically a homeless unit where they kind of put you into hostels from there. I didn't sleep on the street. I was walking the streets until the early hours. But yeah, I mean, that was scary. That was probably the scariest moment. But the hostels were just more about, you know, my first hostel I went into, you was only allowed in there for 14 nights. And, you know, within those 14 nights, you had to be homed. And what they call us home is a hostel. Luckily, I was one that got, you know, housed within those 14 days. And I spent the first couple of years in a hostel where I had to share a room with two others. Yeah, knew nothing about, you know, some of my belongings were getting stolen, and yeah, loads of crazy things were happening. I pretty much lived out of a rucksack, had a sleeping bag that was bought for me from Hopal, which is something that, you know, has always stuck with me. It sounds so silly, but, you know, the bedding that you get that you don't know what's been used, who's used it before, was difficult for me to get comfortable and make the hostel my home, which I knew it was going to be for a while.
And how did it transition from being in a state in Battersea, living near this cage? You mentioned your siblings. How did it go from there, presumably a relatively stable family situation, to being in a hostel?
Yeah, I mean, we had a good upbringing, a difficult upbringing, but certainly a very good one. One that, you know, I'm forever proud of my mum for how, you know, she's brought us four kids up. But it was a struggle for her. We didn't have, you know, our dad wasn't around. It wasn't the best of role models. Lots went on between, you know, mum and dad, and it wasn't comfortable for any of us four kids. But yeah, I think as I got older and more independent, I think I become, you know, a lot like my mum, very stubborn, very independent, and just a family breakdown. I ended up leaving, and yeah, I think because I was so independent from so young, I probably thought I could attack this big bad world on my own, and realised it was more difficult than I thought it would be. But yeah, my stubbornness probably kept me away from my home for longer than I probably needed to be.
So the escapism of football and your talent, your desire, your passion, you could almost say that football, with that pathway, could have saved your life.
Yeah, 100%. And I say that all the time. I think it saved me in so many different ways. And it certainly made me mentally tough, I think, you know, through things that I've kind of overlooked it in my life in terms of what I've had to go through. Football's been the one thing that's kept me strong. So, yeah.
But, you know, it's funny. When people think of elite sport, Farah, they think of things like, you know, great room where you can get a good night's sleep, superb nutrition, a really well-calibrated set of support staff, so you have everything you need to peak on the pitch. But for a while, I'm guessing you had almost none of that. I mean, what was it? What were the mechanics like of how you would get from the hospital to a match, and what you would eat? And, you know, you said you had to share a room from time to time. I mean, that just sounds like a remarkable thing to create a level of virtuosity on the field when you're surrounded by that context.
Yeah, and that they're the sort of things that, you know, trying to be an elite athlete at that time was very difficult. Financially, it was difficult. You know, the hostel wasn't cheap. I had to sign on the dole. I had to do side jobs to try and get some cash in hand, you know, to get some food on the table. And food is something that, you know, my upbringing was something that, you know, my mum was, there would always be, regardless of the struggles, food would always be on the table. So, you know, as kids, we were well fed, if that was, if anything. So yeah, certainly trying to be an elite footballer at the time, and my diet was probably awful, but I'd skip breakfast most of the time. I ended up getting a job in a coffee shop, so I'd pretty much get some lunch there. On the days that I didn't work there, I'd probably, you know, grab a sandwich. But rice was something, and carbs, you know, I knew I could always be full if I had carbs in me. So I'd pretty much, it'd be, you know, most of the time would be rice. It was the cheapest and the most filling meal of an evening that I'd use. If not, it would be pasta. So yeah, I'd pretty much carb load, and it wasn't always good in terms of, it was good because I always felt full, but in terms of weight, you know, I always fluctuated in weight throughout my career.
Matthew, before you come on, Farah, me and Matthew were talking about the series, you know, on a whole, and the common word was hard work, desire, dedication and pathways. And Matthew, when you're speaking to Farah, because obviously this is the first time you've heard Farah speak on this situation, you look physically like stunned, Matthew, and shocked of what Farah's been through.
It's incredible to hear. I mean, one of the beautiful things about football is it is a vehicle for social mobility. I mean, you know, many of the top players in the world have come from tough backgrounds, from Luis Suarez. I mean, it's a remarkable sport. Alex Ferguson's talked about this, but Farah, I've never heard a story like this in my entire life. You're the most capped player in the history of our national sport. And to have done it in those circumstances is such a tribute to your mentality. I mean, I'm interested to know, where do you think that, you mentioned the stubbornness perhaps came from your mother to a certain extent, who brought up four kids with either an absent father or just a very difficult father. Perhaps you could clarify. But there must have, where else do you think you found that mental strength?
I genuinely think it is through my mum. I think, you know, I don't want to go too much into depth without, you know, confirming with her, but she had a tough life with our dad. You know, he certainly didn't make it easy. There was a lot of violence within that, and just her, yeah, her determination to make sure she was always there and okay and strong for us as kids. I think that is what, you know, I always, when people talk about the struggles I've had, you know, there's no one has had, I believe, worse struggles than her. So she's drove me throughout my career, even in times when, you know, we weren't talking, and it was through my stubbornness, not through her. But yeah, she was always and always will be my motivation. I think she's somebody that, I think for what she's done for us as kids, I've always wanted to make her proud. And yeah, that's what drives me on. And, you know, and I've seen her work hard. You know, she's had to, you know, as kids, she'd be working all hours, 3-4 jobs, you know, a day to put food, as I mentioned, on the table. And it's because of that. And to know that things don't come easy. And, she, you know, she certainly demonstrated through our upbringing as kids, you know, hard work gets you a lot further than anything else. So I think it's her.
Can I ask, so first of all, how old were you when you moved out? But also, did you stay in school until 16? What how did you juggle the school and football up until the age when you left school?
Yeah, no, I was in school until 16. I then tried to go to college. I struggled a little bit academically, if I'm honest. And I speak about, you know, I used to go to school and constantly worry about what was going on at home. And that stuck with me. I probably was always distracted in school. Because my mum was always on my mind, and you know, whether it be my real dad or my stepdad, even when I used to get, you know, that bus or train to football, you know, that whole journey for me was such a struggle in terms of trying to switch off from leaving mum at home with, you know, people that, you know, I didn't think she'd be safe with. And it was only when I was on the pitch training did I feel a little bit of security. But yeah, that certainly wasn't easy for me.
See, Matthew, I finally found somebody on this podcast that's got something in common with me. It'd be no surprise that I struggled academically too, Farah. Matthew didn't.
It served you well. You've done well.
That's brilliant. But who did
Matthew,
you
look? You look at Mitch. Farah is like, I can see your reactions to Farah's story, Matthew, from you. You can't comprehend it, can you?
Well, I didn't know anything like it, because you're friends with her. You're intimate with her journey and her story. And of course, you know, I don't have that knowledge that you have. So, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, one thing that strikes me, Rob, is, you know, almost all of us need someone to confide in, someone who can mentor us when we're going through difficult periods. Farah, I know that you were away from your home for that long period of time, but was there anybody you could turn to? I know. I mean, I've looked from a couple of the interviews that I've read about you that Hope Powell was a key influence. Is there anyone else that you would mention as being critically important in that period?
Yeah, I think Hope was really important. I mean, she was my national team coach at the time. She was, you know, the one that took me to King's Cross to get myself put into a hostel. So she was the one that was like, look, you have to sort yourself out. You know, so she was the one that, and she was the one, her and her partner, Michelle, literally, you know, whether it be daily, they're checking on me. I then signed for Everton, and when I'd get the train up on a Friday night, you know, they'd be like a parent in terms of, you know, you make sure you text me when you arrive, and yeah, they constantly checked in on me. I mean, my best mate lived local to my hostel, so, you know, when I, you know, the hostel was good, I could get a shower. It wasn't the cleanest, it wasn't the nicest, I'd get it. And my best mate that I played with at Chelsea when I was very young, you know, lived local, and I got back in contact with her because we'd been out of contact for a little bit. And yeah, I pretty much, you know, if I needed a hot meal at times or if I needed a bath, I'd go around to theirs if they were in. her mum and dad, my mate Lauren and her mum and dad, Lynn and Mick, they were really supportive throughout. In terms of teammates, probably Rachel Brown. She was my roommate, and I mean, yeah, she was not only the best listener, she allowed me to be emotional at times behind closed doors where no one else could see, because, you know, I always wanted to be perceived as somebody that was strong and that never broke. And in front of people, that's kind of what I did. In front of people, you know, I wouldn't allow anyone to break me, whether it be, you know, as a footballer or as a person, I wouldn't show that. And I, again, you know, I get that from my mum. You know, we never ever saw her broken, even though she was completely broken. So I'd say Rachel Brown, you know, and gave me good advice and really supported me throughout my time with her at England.
So when you started playing for Chelsea in 2001, you know, did that stubbornness, did those memories of playing with your brothers in that park in Battersea give you that edge, you know, in a competitive environment?
Yeah, I think so. I always, you know, everyone wants to compare men and women's football, but I always think men just have this buzz about them. They have this competitiveness about them that women don't like to demonstrate as much. And so I think certainly in my early years, you know, I'm saying I was a cocky young teenager. I thought I was the best out there. So whoever I come across, you know, I thought, well, if I can do it against boys, you know, it's even easier against girls. So that was, as a young player, the kind of attitude I had. And I mean, I don't want to swear, but I didn't give, you know, two crap about anybody that was around me at the time. So I definitely think being around boys and sort of like the way they conduct themselves on a field, you know, I certainly picked up on some of that compared to, if I grew up around girls, I probably wouldn't have had that feistiness about me when I was younger.
Can I ask you about that? Because I'm interested in kind of cultural conceptions of femininity. I mean, when I was growing up, it was definitely considered unfeminine to really try hard on the sports pitch and to sweat and to battle and to fight. It was kind of not seen as womanly. Do you think that is changing now? I mean, when you look at the popularity of women's football in this country and the kind of resurgence of a different conception of what it is to be a woman, do you think that's changed, or do you think there is still a problem with the idea that men can fight and it's macho to fight, but women who fight hard, it's somehow they're showing something that is unfeminine?
I mean, I definitely think it's changing. As I said, as a kid, yeah, it was something that wasn't normal, you know, for females to sweat and fight and, you know, it, for me as a young female growing up, wasn't normal, wasn't accepted. As I say, I was lucky that I had two brothers and probably didn't get so much of the name calling. I was accepted, but I know, you know, a lot of females and young girls, even now growing up, probably get that. It still goes on, but in terms of it changing, I definitely think it's changing. I think, you know, if you look at how many female PTs there are now that are demonstrating actually being physical and strong, you know, also can look good on females. I think it's definitely more acceptable. I think, you know, people are male and female attracted to it, which I don't think they were so many years ago. It wasn't normal for females to be or look physically better than men. But I feel like, yeah, I certainly feel like that's changing now.
Joe, it's interesting. We interviewed Judy Murray on this podcast and she talked about the change in her life. You know, when she was a mother, and encouraging her son to play well at Wimbledon and pumping her fist and giving advice. And she said that people would write hate mail. You know, there'd be headlines saying, you know, this nasty mother. They wanted her to be demure like Tim Henman's mum. Now, people admire it. And isn't that a wonderful thing that sport has been one of the things that has kind of catalysed change in that way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and for her to stick, you know, stick with it and believe in what she was doing for her son is, you know, as you say, it would have been difficult for her to do that every single week and encourage that, but the fact that she continues to do it and probably through that has, you know, has made change with that. I mean, the amount of mums now that you see that are more aggressive in, you know, in supporting their kids, whether they be male or female, in any sort of sport or in any sort of walk of life is so much better to see. You know, it used to be the dad that used to be the driving force behind kids and them being competitive or them doing well. And you know, equally, I think, you know, now you see that from both mum and dad, even grandparents, you know, it's seen as normal or more normal now.
Back with the next question shortly, but first we're going to tell you about this. Investing is one of the best ways to grow wealth over the long term. However, high commissions and clunky products from traditional stockbrokers can sometimes make it complicated for people to start investing. Meanwhile, trillion-dollar companies get built, but very few people benefit from that wealth creation.
The intuitive design makes investing simple for any experience level. beginners and experts alike. You can start investing from just £2.
They are all about long-term investing with a transparent pricing model and no hidden fees or inflated spreads. When you invest, your capital is at risk. The value of investments can go up as well as down, and you may receive back less than your original investment. Go to freetrade.io/talent, and if you register and fund your account, you'll get a randomly allocated free share worth between £3 and £200, such as Greggs, Rightmove, or Apple.
For more information, visit freetrade.io. Do you know what, as well, Farah, what, you know, I wanted to be a centre forward. I was wanted the one to score the goals as a kid. You know, everybody in my school wanted to be the number nine, to get all the glory. But I found out I was a midfield player relatively later in my career because of my energy, because of my tenacity. And I didn't really start playing in midfield until I was 21, 22. Did you always know you were going to be a midfield player because you wanted in that cage? And I always take you back to that cage in Battersea. You were in the heart of it. You had to fight. You were stubborn. Did you always see yourself as that combative midfield player? Technically, what were you like? You know, were you, was your competitive nature better than your technical ability? And what pathway did you choose, or did it choose you?
No, so I think I was more, I mean, you had to be feisty because obviously, as I say, you're playing against, I mean, you'd be in a cage, you can imagine, up to 30 people at times. And, you know, back then it was about, you know, you couldn't even find a pass. So in terms of, if I'm thinking about trying to find passes, it was more about being able to protect it, being able to beat players. You know what, I started, when I played in school, because I played it, they didn't have a girls team, so it was a boys team. I was only allowed to play in goal. Absolutely hated getting dirty, but because I wanted to play, I'd go in goal and I'd play, and yeah, I was allowed to do that. I ended up in my first team, they thought I was more like a striker, and I think that was just because, you know, I'd score from range and I could score goals, and I, as you say, that comes from the cage. You know, any opportunity to shoot, you'd get your shot away. So I think in my first year, you know, they pretty much played me as a striker, and then I got into, like, you know, the county team, and the coach there, you know, because he thought that I, you know, I understood the game, even though I was, what, 12 or 13. He played me as a sweeper. I mean, he must have been watching Hoddle or something. I don't know who he was watching, but, like, I don't know where he got this role from. And he put me as a sweeper. And then, yeah, I just transferred into a midfielder. And I pretty much played as a 10 throughout my younger years. But I think because the game weren't as advanced, then I really enjoyed learning the game. I think my understanding of football was probably, at the time of my development as a young player, was probably a little bit better than some of the players around me. And so because of that, they put me as that holding midfielder to try and dictate the game and find passes and kind of, yeah, as I say, be that playmaker from deeper areas. And it's only in the last 4 years since I've joined Reading have they put me back up into the 10. So I think, yeah, I wish I'd stayed in a 10 for longer as a younger player, because I actually, you know, enjoy playing higher up the pitch.
So when are you actually going to find a pass?
When you do.
Farah, during the podcast, we've got three questions that we asked all the guests. Here's the first one. What was the weakest part of your skill set and the one you had to work the hardest on to improve?
Do you know what? As competitive as I hate defending. I hate it. I'm one of them that likes to read the game and intercept. So I'd say probably, yeah, physically 1v1 defending. I still hate it today. I'm more of somebody, as I mentioned, that reads it and tries to nick a yard.
But as a good reader of the game, do you think that you want to go into management? Because a lot of people who are successful in management have got a very good perceptual awareness as players. Do you think that might be a stepping stone for you?
Yeah, I mean, I coach now. I've always wanted to coach. I think, you know, from a very young age, I've always wanted to be a coach. Management, I think I want to learn my trade a little bit as a coach and develop those management skills. I think they're two completely separate roles. I think sometimes you get caught up in thinking being a great coach, you have to, you know, become a great manager. I like contact on the pitch. I like to demonstrate that. I like the interaction with players. I think as a manager, you have to, you know, be able to understand players are different and how you manage players differently. I'd need to get that skill set. I don't think I fully have it. But yeah, it's something that I want to learn. I want to learn how to, you know, manage players differently. yeah, and be a boss. I think that's what the managers are. You have to be authoritative, and yeah, at the minute I'm not quite there. But certainly in terms of coaching and being an assistant coach, you know, at a top level, it's something that I'd love to do, you know, pretty much as soon as I finish my career.
I love that answer, Robbie, because I think in a lot of walks of life, people assume because they can do something as a performer, they're going to be brilliant at managing or teaching. And as you say, they're completely different. In fact, you know, it's often if somebody's very, very good at something, they're less good at explaining how they do it to somebody who isn't as good as they are, because they can almost do it without thinking. It becomes second nature.
It was like you at table tennis, except for table tennis, but your speeches are hopeless. Farrah, you know, I was with Brendan. We'd done the Brendan Rodgers on this podcast, and I was talking to him about me as a grassroots coach and me as a director of football. And he said to me, one thing you need is a philosophy, wasn't it, Matthew? What is your philosophy, either as a manager or as a coach? And he said, when you see a Brendan Rodgers team, I would like to think that people will know what my philosophy is. You know, if you are a coach or a manager, what would your philosophy be?
I've been trying to do this for ages, and every time you do a coaching course, that's one of the things that they always, you know, put. And mine is, you know, I want to be able to create a winning team. And what that looks like will determine on the opposition. So I've always said, you know, to win games and to be an adaptable, hard-working team, because I think, you know, you can have a certain way of playing. And I don't know, you know, the men's side, when I watch it, is, you know, when you look at a Pep team, you know, throughout his career, he's pretty much had a style that he stuck to, and it's worked pretty much wherever he's been. But yeah, how I see it in teams that I've been in, we've always had to be adaptable to be successful. And you know, if it means, for me, you know, I look at teams like Arsenal now, for example, in the Premier League, and, you know, they play out so much and they're so uncomfortable in doing it. So for me, if that isn't available, for me, you have to play the long ball game and you have to play percentage football. And yeah, so for me, I mean, at the minute, I'm trying to define my philosophy, but it certainly will be to develop a winning team. And within that, they, you know, they're certainly going to be adaptable and hardworking. And defensively structured.
Let me ask you the second set question, Farrah, which is, what is the one thing you haven't got any talent in but wish you had?
Oh, mate.
Passing.
A lot of things. Passing. stop talking about my strengths like that. do you know what? Singing or dancing, I'm awful.
You can't sing or dance?
No, I wish I could dance. I don't really care about singing too much. I wish I could dance. On a night out, it's just a drink in the hand and a two-step. That's the most you'll, that's the most you'll get.
But you're, I'd have thought you'd have rhythm. Maybe you should. Rob, she'd be great on Strictly. You could see her improving through time. Would you, if they asked you, would you do it?
Strictly, maybe dancing on ice, because you can get away with not having to move so much. not Strictly.
What would you, Farrah, if you had to pick out your greatest achievement, on and off the pitch, what would you pick? What would be the highlight of your career so far?
You know what, when I get asked this, I mean, representing England has to be the ultimate. I mean, it was something that as a kid I probably never ever dreamed of, because, you know, there was no visibility in women's football back then, to know that there was a national team that potentially I could be a part of. But probably, if I look at my career, staying at the top for as long as I have, still at 37 playing in the top league, not having to lower the leagues because, you know, my quality or standard dropped off. It's probably, I think I've been in it for over 20 years now. So to stay at the top for that long, I'd probably say it's my biggest achievement in football.
You know, Farrah, also, you know, I used to watch women's football. I go back to Doncaster Bells. It used to be on Channel 4. And we now see how the WSL, you know, the England national team, how women's football has evolved. You know, how have you seen the changes? Has it become more professional? The awareness, you know, the coverage. How has it evolved? Because it's in such a brilliant place now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's in, you know, it's certainly changed over the years, and it's in an unbelievable place now. And, you know, certainly I think for the media attention, I think Phil Neville done a fantastic job in drawing that attention. I think previous coaches done well in developing the players, and especially the England team. I think that they're a team now that, you know, potentially can go on in the next few years to win a tournament. But you know what's so gutting about it is that I was able to play in both generations of players that, you know, had to go and work and play. And the talent back then, you know, I always think about the players that I played with and looked up to back then, and players I had around me, and you know, they were fantastic people, and they were so dedicated to the sport along with having to work. I would love to have seen how, if they had the opportunities we have now to be full time, how good a player they could have been. Because there were some unbelievable players back then that I, you know, and I talk about it sometimes to the kids, and they have no idea who these players are. And yeah, I mean, they were fantastic, and certainly helped me develop, you know, as a player, and was very good to me as a young player coming through, in teaching me, you know, so many core values in the sport.
And we've seen recently. The Chelsea manager, Emma Hayes, who, you know, I watch her side play football, fantastic manager. I listen to on the radio, speaks so well. Linked with a job, you know, in the men's game. I believe that, you know, her credentials, what she's achieved, for me, she could easily manage in the men's game. Do you think that would be difficult? Do you think it's something we'll see? Personally, I'd love to see Emma Hayes managing, you know, in the men's game, because she's good enough, and she's proven she's good enough. Do you think we'll see it?
I think we will, and I think potentially she could be the one that leads that. I think it has to be appealing to her. I think, you know, she has, as you mentioned, what she's done and how she's turned this Chelsea women's team and how she's grown them over the years. And, you know, I'm the same. I listen to her on Sky when she does the debate show, and I listen to her on radio, and she's unbelievable. She's a fantastic coach, a manager. You know, management skills is, you know, to pick, you know, she has the best players in the world at Chelsea, and that's the difference between being a good coach and a manager, being able to manage those players. And you know what it's like when you're around so many top players, how do you keep them all on board with everyone wanting to play? So she certainly has it, and you know, she's certainly somebody that is thick-skinned, is tough enough to go into the men's game and be criticised, you know, because that will come with it. And I think she's certainly somebody that could go in and do that. But yeah, to the job that she was offered, I mean, there's no disrespect to that, but you know, she deserves better than that. I think for what she's done, you know, I think she even mentioned it herself, why wasn't Frank Lampard offered the job? You know, he'd just been sacked from Chelsea, why her? Because she's a female. And is it, you know, she's somebody that really wants to drive our game forward and open up doorways and pathways for other women and girls coming through. And yeah, it would have to be right for her to do it, and not just a, you know, a media kind of attention, or you know, to try and change it. I think, you know, it has to be the right move and something that she believes she can go in and change and do well in.
I've just got to pick you up on something. Sorry, Matthew, I've just got to pick Farah up on something there that you said, Farah, that I'd know what it's like being around top players. Well, I don't.
No, you wouldn't know. I was going to say, I should have come back. No, you wouldn't know, would you? You only chase them around the pitch, don't you? I forgot.
Let me ask you the third question of the set questions, Farah. What's the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you, and who said it?
It was probably really it was Hope Power and Mo Marley. They played a big part in my playing career, and it was, you know what it's like when you're young and you're trying to choose your pathway, and it's really difficult. You have mates that you want to go on the same journey with, but everybody's different. And I was that young kid that just enjoyed, you know, the comfort of having a security in terms of like a friend. You know, sometimes home didn't always feel secure. So just having, you know, my best mate there, I used to just want to do everything with them and follow their path. And her advice was that, and it's, you know, she said, at the end of your career, if you can count, you know, on one hand, you know, the people that were there from the start, your journey to the end, you've done really well. And as a young player, I didn't really understand what that meant. But as I started to develop and was getting picked for the national team and started to get some success, your circle got smaller and smaller and smaller. So it probably was the best advice in terms of understanding that, you know, sometimes you have to go alone on these journeys, and, you know, people that really want you to do well, you know, they'll still be there with you. I didn't understand it, as I say, when it was mentioned to me, but it's certainly something that, you know, when I look at now, I've probably got one one that's still there. No, I have got a handful, but they were right in what they said. So yeah, it was really good advice, because yeah, I could have easily followed friends that have now, you know, quit really young and didn't go on to achieve what I did.
And what's one piece of advice, Farah, you would give personally now to a young girl starting their journey, you know, as a professional footballer?
just what I've always, I've loved the game. So I think that's been why I've been so motivated. I just love football. So I think you've got to enjoy it. But I've always wanted to learn. And I don't know whether that's the coaching side in me that I've wanted to learn, or I've always wanted to develop. And even now at 37, you know, I go in every day and try and learn something new. So I think those two for me come in hand. If you're enjoying it, you're going to want to learn and push and get more out of it. So they're the two things that I've always focused on in my career. And when I fall out of love with the game is when I retire. But yeah, I'd give that advice to anyone coming through.
And we've known the barriers, we've known your dedication, we've known your desire, we've known your pathway. And you say you're 37 now, and you know, I seen recently on Instagram you posted about your kidney diagnosis and the illness you've now thankfully overcoming, another terrible situation in your wonderful career, another barrier has been put in front of you. Just tell us a little bit about what happened.
I think it was back in May, so I was just basically coming to the end of my rehab for a hip operation that I had. I think we spoke about it before when I was going through it. We had a podcast, but I was, you know, yeah. I was recovering from a hip. I just noticed swelling in different areas within the body, kind of that stubbornness about me. I was just ignoring them, was putting it out. Maybe it's the weather, the, you know, allergies or whatever. And it wasn't until my stomach really swelled that I panicked, because I was struggling to breathe. Took myself to A&E. And yeah, they pretty much through I did chest x-rays, bloods and urine, and pretty much said I'd had nephrotic syndrome, which is a kidney condition, basically leaking all your protein, which is supposed to hold on to, into your body. So I had a lot of fluid in the tissues of my body. And a kidney biopsy confirmed it. I had a kidney biopsy, you know, a couple of days later, which confirmed that I'd had this nephrotic syndrome, and put on really high dose steroids, which literally changed my whole image. And I really struggled with that mentally.
Where is that now? Is it something that has now moved from an acute to a chronic thing? Is it something you'll get regular checkups? How is it?
Yeah,
now?
I'm in remission now, and I'm now off the medication. Pretty much with this condition, you can relapse at any point. It's something that I'll live with from now. Normally, young kids get diagnosed with it. You normally get diagnosed, so somebody of my age, and certainly, you know, my consultant was saying it's very rare that somebody of my age, and certainly, you know, being sporty, with a sporty background, they'd never dealt with anybody, you know, with that. But yeah, I felt so ill at the time that them telling me I was going on steroids, I probably didn't think too much about it. I'm somebody that never takes medication, paracetamol, you know, I don't go near them. I took this medication, and I didn't realise all the side effects that come with taking steroids, and I've just felt horrible for near 6 months now.
I'm so glad you're coming out the other side. And Robbie, what are your reflections? I mean, this has just been an extraordinary...
Incredible, yeah. Most privilege. One of the most inspirational friends, I'd like to say. You know, I've had the pleasure to get to know the story. You know, we've all heard stories in this podcast of how hard workers played their part, but what Farah's had to contend with at the start of her career and her life, you know, and now obviously at the end of, not the end of her career,
the latter stages of her career.
Rephrase that, mate. At the latter stages of her career. It's quite remarkable. You know,
good
what
recovery.
A truly inspirational player. And as you said, the most capped England international of all time is quite remarkable. And as she's mentioned loads of times in NBA.
Would you describe Robbie as a friend as well, Farah?
Yeah, most definitely. And you know what? I think I actually think he brings the best out of me. I mean, the time he's given me since I've, you know, got to know him for our agency. Yeah, the time that he puts into me, I'm forever grateful for. I think he certainly brings it in terms of my personality. He's somebody that can get the very best out of that. And yeah, that's a compliment to him. He still can't pass.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Farah, it's been a joy. Yeah. Thank you. And I would second what you said. I'd hate to second it, but I second what you say about Rob. And look, thank you so much, Farah.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. This is the last episode of Series 1. Robbie and I have hugely enjoyed it. We'll be back later in the year with a second series. But until then, from Robbie, from me, from Farah, a very goodbye.